And this is brought to you, this remote viewing special, by UFOCon. And UFOCon is probably the number one conference on the West Coast for UFO information. And it's coming up in Santa Clara, California very soon. Are you curious about extraterrestrials, UFOs, alien abductions, implants? I can go on the secrets of space programs and what they are. And then, of course, Area 51 and other UFO hotspots and topics. Then you don't want to miss the UFO Con, September 15th and 16th in Santa Clara, California. There are 13 speakers, including Douglas Dietrich. He'll be presenting Roswell, as you never heard it before, in a very interesting theory he has. Daryl Sims, known as the Alien Hunter, will be there, and he has some new information and some new research he's been doing, and he'll be revealing that, these new discoveries about implants. Chris O'Brien, who is in, you know, around Colorado taking pictures all the time of paranormal activity, he'll be there with his camera, and he'll be talking about camera surveillance of UFOs in hotspots and other places, and what you can actually do in regard to taking pictures of UFOs. Laura Eisenhower will be there too. And her almost mission to Mars, which I can't wait to hear. Anyway, joining them again will be Richard Dolan, Alfred Lambert, Weber, and Dr. Weber, always interesting, Jordan Maxwell, Michael Surratt, and he knows just about everything there is to know about secret black operations, especially about aircraft. So you might plan on meeting those special guests, and there'll be special guests at this conference, by the way, Sean David Morton, who attracts a lot of interest as well. John Wells on Saturday night will be the host of Coast to Coast from there. So,
again, where this will be?
This is going to be in Santa Clara, California, and it's going to be there September 15th and 16th. Very interesting. I'll give the website here in a little bit, and people can go over and find out about it. And it's very interesting. I'll give the website right now, Russell, since you asked. It's UFOCon2012.com. That's UFOCon2012.com. We are now going to bring on Lynn Buchanan.
Jerry, I can say that's so close to me that I'll come that Saturday and Sunday and just make trouble asking questions from the floor.
Okay, great. Great. I knew you lived right by there. That's
yeah,
great.
I live very close.
Yeah. Fantastic. Okay, we're going to get Lynn Buchanan on the line next. We were talking to Lynn a little earlier via Skype, and I think he's there in Alamogordo now.
Yep, I'm here. Can you hear me?
How you doing?
Okay, how about you?
Okay, it's great to have you on again. Lynn Buchanan, say hello to our other two guests so far. We have Russell Targ and Courtney Brown.
Good. Hi to both of you. And I just wanted to say to you, Jerry, thank you for having me on the show with this group. Russell, of course, you know, Courtney was talking about the generations, and Russell is first generation, being military. I was the second generation, and we have the people that we teach remote viewing to, which wind up being the third generation, and we even now have teachers, some of them, taking up the flag and teaching to a fourth generation, and so this thing is really taking on, and it's taking on because it can prove itself. Russell was talking about, you know, proof. And it's exactly like Russell says. It's ridiculous to look at the proof that's there and still turn a blind eye to the fact that it exists. And the work that Russell is doing, and Courtney, and several others, the Hawaii Remote Viewers Group. I see Dick is on with us, Dick Allgaier, and Lauren Cott, who's doing some fantastic work. You know, well,
great,
it's just
great. Now you're the executive director of Problem Solutions Innovations.
Yeah.
What is that exactly?
When I got out of the military, the remote viewing was still classified, and I started a data analysis company in Washington, D.C. area called Problem Solutions Innovations. When this became declassified, I started getting all kinds of calls for training and you know, consulting, police work, archaeological work, and all that. And it dawned on me, you know, I don't have to drive into D.C. every day anymore. So I turned Problem Solutions Innovations into a remote viewing company and training and service company. But my background is in databasing. And so, you know, we database the work of all of our students, all of our viewers, when we do a project for people. We get feedback from them as to the accuracy of what we provided, and we database that. We don't just say, okay, thank you. And as a result, we have each viewer has a databased track record. And Russell is absolutely right. Like alternate universes or things in the past, you know, what did Jesus's mustache look like and things like that. There's no proof from that. And so the only proof that we have for operational work is a viewer's track record. And we look and we see a viewer is, a single viewer is, let's say, 80% accurate in his perception of colors, but 20% accurate in describing shapes or sizes or something. Well, we know how much to trust the perceptions he give us on targets where there either is not or may not be feedback.
Then would you have, if you were looking for a lost child, for example,
yes, uh-huh,
would you have a single viewer doing that, or would you have a team doing it?
Oh, no, I would have a team doing it. One of the problems with remote viewing is that it's humans doing it. And, you know, as long as it's a human doing it, it's not going to be completely accurate. You're going to have mistakes. It's like doing, you would never do an entire project with only one viewer and even one session. The thing is, let's say the, take a hypothetical case. The police want to know who it was that abducted a child. Okay. They have several witnesses, and the witnesses, eyewitnesses, all give different stories. And they say, okay, we want to know description of where the person lives. We want a description of what the person does for a living, their car, and so on. We would look in the database and say, okay, we want to know the color of the car. Find the viewer that's most accurate in colors. Then we want to know the shape of the car and the condition of the car. Find the viewer for that information, which has proven over hundreds of sessions that he's most accurate in that. And you never trust an important project to just one person or even one session. And then when you hand the information into the police, they don't send out the troops on that. They put it into the pool with their other information, and it, you know, stirs into the pot to give them a better overall look. So,
do you do a lot of police work?
We used to. We had a lawyer join us, and he sort of took over to legalize the work we were doing with police, and he made such an enemy of the police that they just sort of stopped calling us. We have built up a new.
You're gonna be careful about lawyers here. The producer of this show is a lawyer.
Yeah.
Joe Champion.
We have reestablished friendship with many departments, and we're doing things, and we're doing some good. I haven't been too quick to do that because back when we were doing so much, it was just eating up everything that we did, all of our time, all of my time. I wasn't getting anything else done and all that. And so while I do worry about missing children, I know that you find one, and the time it takes to find one, 50 more are abducted and so on.
What's the thing that you can do that you do most reliably?
That we do most reliably?
If I wanted to hire you to do something for me, what's the thing that you have the greatest success at?
So far, the greatest success that we seem to have had, mainly because we can get feedback on it, is working for businesses. We love doing archaeological work. The archaeologists don't tend to give us feedback like they should. But the business plans and intentions, research and development, you know, scientific research and development, or even mechanical research and development, we've had great success with space exploration companies. And the police departments, like I say, we've backed off on that quite a bit, and yet it's still my favorite. But, you know, we provided...
I guess it gave you a feeling of doing some redeeming social value there. I mean, you could see the results.
Yeah, listen,
have a website. Is it crviewer.com?
That's it, uh-huh. Yeah, you study remote viewing for a couple of years, and after that couple of years, you know, you're tired of practice targets, you're tired of everything else, and you bring home one missing child, and it's worth it.
You know, I might chime in.
Courtney, I was going to ask you to get in involved here.
Yeah, I might chime in here that with regard to sort of criminal type of cases, there are individual viewers that do participate with law enforcement regularly, and they do interact with Lynn and so on. Angela Thompson-Smith just participated in it's now become rather famous, case involving law enforcement that really was really quite remarkable.
Yes.
Des Smith also, who has worked with Lynn a great deal, works regularly in Britain with law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
And Joe McMonagle has worked with law enforcement.
Oh, yeah.
And all of these people have worked individually. And Lynn is absolutely correct. It's nice to work with teams. But there are sometimes individuals that work with law enforcement.
And don't forget Pam Coronado.
Yeah, Pam Coronado, of course, yeah.
Pam has worked with the FBI extensively and with different police departments and had great success at it.
I'm going to bring in Dick Allgear here from Hawaii as we need to go along here. Lynn Buchanan, you got anything else you want to talk about your company before we get I got a lot of questions already in the chat room and emails banged up here and some phone calls. We're not going to go on the phone calls for another 30 minutes or so, folks.
Okay. Yeah,
I have a general question. I worked for a couple of years with Pat Price, as you know, and Pat was a unique psychic. And we were called, I'm going to tell a story, which some of you know parts of. We were called in by the detective agency in Berkeley after Patricia Hearst was kidnapped.
Mm-hmm.
And Hal and I went to the police department with Pat Price, and Pat turned the pages of the mug book they had with hundreds of pictures, and he put his finger on Donald DeVries, who was, in fact, the kidnapper, but no one knew that. And he said, that's the ringleader. And the police said, well, that's interesting. We know who that guy is, but haven't seen him for a year. Where are they? Which way they go with the heiress?
Yeah.
He said, oh, They're about 50 miles north of here. They're in a white station wagon next to a diner across the freeway from some tall white gas cylinders, and there's a pedestrian overpass across the freeway. When the detective said, "I know where that is, it's on my way home to Vallejo," they dispatched a police cruiser. In 10 minutes, they had found the car that still had cartridges rolling around on the floorboards that we could recognize from our earlier trip to Patricia's house in Berkeley. So that all took half an hour.
Yeah.
And that was entirely correct.
I said I wasn't going to take any phone calls, but we have a student at Lens. We have a student at Lens on the phone here, I think. Is he still here, Joe? If he is, let's put him on. Okay, he'll be calling back in about 30 minutes. So, I wanted to give you another little boost there, Lynn, but he took me at my word. I wasn't going to take phone calls for another 30 minutes.
Okay, but Russ still has
questions. My question is, how unusual is Pat Price?
Oh, extremely. I don't know of anyone who can do that, even very highly talented psychics. And,
Joe McMonagle could do it.
Yeah.
Hella Hammond was able to do that.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
I did it the one time they called me in.
To that degree?
Not to that degree. I was able to identify a murderer accurately enough so he confessed when he was confronted with the idea that a witness saw him.
Oh, yeah. Well, we've had people be able to, describe locations and describe the culprit, describe victims, and describe key witnesses, also to describe the location of missing evidence and so forth. But to the degree that Pat Price could do it, no. I've never known anybody who can do it to that degree.
Okay. Dick Alger, are you there? I don't know if we called him yet or not. We need to get him on.
Yes, I'm here. Aloha from Hawaii. Hi, Jerry.
How you doing?
I'm pretty good.
Yeah, we're talking about, I thought of you immediately because you're a TV newsman, or were for many years, so we're talking about crime issues here.
Well,
and if it bleeds, it leads.
Yeah. First, let me say aloha to Lynn and Russell and Courtney. Hello, everybody.
Aloha.
And to the listeners around the world. It's a beautiful afternoon in Hawaii. If you're talking about forensic remote viewing, I would say the best forensic remote viewing work for law enforcement is never actually seen or published.
Right.
So Lynn.
If I can speak to that, when we work for the police departments, they usually ask, what we want for pay. And what we do is, we ask for either a department baseball cap or a department coffee mug for each one of the viewers. And you'll sometimes go into a viewer's home and he'll be a shelf in the hallway or something like that that has police department coffee mugs and baseball hats lining down the thing. And it's a thing of quiet pride for the viewers.
Yeah. Well, so I'll tell you a little bit about myself. I've been a professional journalist for 38 years, a TV reporter, most recently at the ABC affiliate in Honolulu, and I've won some awards for excellence in journalism. So that's my day job. I became interested in remote viewing back in 1996 when I heard Lynn Buchanan on the radio and Courtney Brown on the radio and Joe McMonagle and others. And so when I heard about it back then in the mid-90s, I thought to myself, well now, if this is true, wouldn't that be something? So I began investigating it, and I attended Courtney Brown's Far Sight. I read about CRV and studied that a little bit, and then that all got me started. And then I met Glenn Wheaton, who was a former remote viewer for U.S. Army Special Forces, and he's been teaching us out here in Hawaii for 15 years, and I've been working with him for 15 years.
Is he a member of the Hawaii Remote Viewers Guild?
Glenn Wheaton is the president and founder.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah. While most journalists find out about a subject by going out and interviewing experts and talking to people who have experienced something, talking to people who have knowledge about something, I spent the time to actually learn the skill to prove it for myself. So I've done many, many sessions. I've been studying with Glenn ongoing, nonstop, for 15 years. I've taken part in projects. I've designed and run and published projects. I teach remote viewing. My students have been published. And I'm one of the lab rats, too, for some of these studies. So it's been far and away the most interesting thing I've ever been involved with. It's just fascinating. It's always something new and interesting, and you learn a lot about yourself and about reality.
Now, how do people in Hawaii find you? They probably, most people probably know about you, but do you have a website?
Well, for our remote viewing work, the website is hrvg.org, Hawaii Remote Viewers Guild.org, O-R-G, hrvg.org. And if you poke around in the library there in the sessions, the one thing we do at HRVG is we publish our work. If we do a project or make claims or teach people, we put the work up. We're about making the case for remote viewing, about demonstrating that this is real and it really works. So HRVG.org, if you Google my name, you'll find all kinds of stuff. My TV.
What kind of project are you working on right now?
Can you tell me? Can't talk about that. There's a rule in remote viewing, and that is
okay.
No target talk, because you want your viewers, you have to be blind. We even want the analysts to be blind. So we have some interesting things going on, and we can talk about them later. I would say one of the most interesting things we did recently was in conjunction with Courtney Brown, and that was the his peer-reviewed study in the Scientific Journal. We were going around about that earlier, but it was called Remote Viewing the Future with Tasking Temple Outbounder. Why I think this is important is we did remote viewing sessions under indisputable scientific protocol successfully, accurately, and precisely, and we described events a month before they happened. And Lynn Buchanan was one of the taskers for these. So we would sit down and do a session, and we would give that session to Courtney Brown, and he would encrypt the session and put it on the Internet so anyone could download that, but they couldn't look at it. They could hold that on their computer for verification. Then, a month later, an event would happen. And a month after that, either Lynn Buchanan or Glenn Wheaton would task that as a target. So we did the sessions before the event and before the tasking. Why this is important is Courtney has proven that remote viewers can remote view an event before it's even tasked, before it even happens. And this was done so that the public could download the sessions and hold them on their computer, but not look at them until...
Can I ask you how you determined whether the remote viewing was actually correct?
Well, actually, Russell, you need to read the article to do that. It's a ton of there's all the articles. The article has a lot of analysis in it, and it's very easy to do it. These are not sessions that are fuzzy data with a lot of stuff that has to be vaguely interpreted. These are very clear sessions with very clear descriptions of the targets. The issue has always been that it's relatively easy for people to remote view the past or the present. Remote viewing the future has always been the big bugaboo, the big difficulty thing. This led me into the thinking that this multiple reality thing might actually be involved here, because if there are multiple realities, then you know which one you want in the past. If the Titanic sank in your time stream, then you know which one you want, so there's no ambiguity with that. But if it's in the future, and if there are multiple realities, then it would be impossible to predict any particular future. So the idea was to have the tasker, the person who designed the target, go into the future to be cooperating with us. And so the whole idea of this, you don't have to buy the multiple universes interpretation, but the issue is when you have a future temporal outbounder, somebody in the future cooperating with you in the experiments so that that person is picking the targets. Now, the sessions are already done in the past. The targets themselves are any event that could happen in the world after the sessions have already been done, downloaded by tens of thousands of people, encrypted. They can't see them, but they know we can't cheat. And then after that, a third month down the road, then the tasker picks some event anywhere in the world, identifies what that is, posts it up on the website, posts up the passwords to decrypt the sessions, and then you have really good descriptions of future events that happened a month after the sessions were done and that were chosen a month after the events actually occurred. Now, how we actually analyze that is in the, there's tabular data, it's multiple different ways of analyzing, it's a large discussion, but it's in the actual article, and I encourage people that are interested in it to go to farsight.org, click on the banner that says latest peer-reviewed published research, it's a very interesting article, and then to read it.
Well, yeah, this is Dick. Let me chime in on that, because there are a lot of listeners here listening to this show right now wondering what we're, you know, discussing and maybe somewhat arguing about. They can go to the farsight.org and look at that, look at the article and look at the session work. And the, all of the sessions are on your site, aren't they, Courtney?
Yes, all the sessions are there as well.
You published excerpts in the peer review published article, but all the sessions are published on the site.
So that is true for all of our sessions.
People can judge for themselves. So, Russell, I'd ask you, when you just claimed that when you teach people, and I believe you do, and I'm sure it's great training, but you said you guarantee they'll have a psychic event because you're going to be with them for a week and they're going to describe an object. We would ask you, is this randomized? Is there a control group? Is it replicated? Is it published? Well, how can you criticize Courtney's scientifically peer-reviewed article? And you haven't read it, but you're demanding a level of proof from him that you're not offering with your training.
Well, there's several questions. That is, what I'm doing is basically playing with a couple of dozen people for a week so that everyone has a chance to describe some object that was randomly chosen by somebody else. So it's not a publishable experiment. I'm not claiming that I did a published experiment. I thought I was asking an easy question, like, you have a certain number of viewers describing future things. How do you know it was correct? Or does everybody perfectly describe every target?
There's a scaling that's involved. But Russell, you know, you have published a lot of work, and I like all of it. I think you've done a tremendous job over the years in publishing a great deal of stuff. In any one of your articles that you've published, I'm not going to stand here and say, well, Russell, what did you do to determine this claim that you're making?
I could answer that in one sentence. I would say we took all of the targets, and a judge matched up all of the targets against all of the transcripts and got X matched correctly, in a double-blind matching.
That's a very minimal description, and that has been done with all of our research.
I would
say that, in fact, you've actually done a great deal more than that in your published research. And if you read the article, you'll see that we've done a great deal more, and you'll see
a different kind of question, then. If the work is as positive as we all think it is, and this is something that we can get feedback from Hawaii about, why do people still not believe in the existence of ESP? Where does the resistance come from?
Now, that is an incredibly interesting question.
Hold on to that thought, as they say, and we need to answer that question, but I want to bring in the other panelists before we get to that. And, you know, we're about 6 minutes past the top of the hour, so I need to identify what people are listening to. Dick can identify that if no one else can. This is Jerry Pippin's show, and I'm Jerry Pippin, and actually it's a special tonight, and it's a special on remote viewing, and we have five
And the fifth one we'll be introducing in just a second, top remote viewers, in my opinion. And we're discussing issues just like what we were talking about before I jumped in to take the break. You're listening to this on the Inception Radio Network, and this program is brought to you in part by the UFOCon. It's being held September 15th and 16th in Santa Clara, California. And they have 13 speakers, including some very, very interesting people. And one of the most interesting to me, of course, is the ideas, as you know, if you listen to my shows, we do a lot of Roswell programs, and Douglas Dietrich's going to be there with an alternative Roswell hypothesis. And so that he's only one of 13 speakers. We'll talk more about that later. It's coming up September 15th and 16th, the UFOCon in Santa Clara, California.